And we're live with our 299th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Happy to be here. We've been off for a couple of weeks. There's quite a bit that's been going on. I think a lot of it has realistically been other commitments, life commitments that Ken and I have had. So we have been off trying to deal with, you know, running business, building product, all the other things that happen, dealing, you know, supporting family, whatever else is actually there. But we're back today. So I'm excited to be here. A couple of announcements. The training, Harnessing LLMs for Application Security. There was an issue with some, anyway, whatever. It's going to be November 20th and 21st. This is definitely a go, as we have people that have signed up and would love to have you. There are a few seats that are left. This is a virtual course. It's a follow-on to the course that we've done at DEF CON most recently. There's going to be, again, new elements to this, right? LLMs are changing the way that we interact with them. I mean, just this week, OpenAI has their new agentic workflow that they have released. There's been discussions about the big agents that will run for 30 plus hours and do all sorts of things that you can train. So it's becoming more and more powerful as far as what you can actually do using some of these workflows, using some of these ideas. But we will give the basics of LLMs in this course, how to interact with them, how to script it up. So you don't have to use a workflow tool. You can use your own Python, your own scripts to actually interact and create those agents and do what you want to do. There's a lot of strategy that goes into it. So yeah, please come join us. Now, if you are going to be at Black Hat Europe, you're thinking about a larger course that you want to dig into, actually the source code review, the secure code review, that methodology, using LLMs for that. We have that course is selling out and it's selling quickly. So if you would like to join us in Europe, there's a link to it on our on training.appsec.com, but I just posted the other link as well directly to the Black Hat site, the Next Gen Secure Code Review. This is a combination of harnessing LLMs with the Secure Code Review framework. So this is purpose-built for Black Hat to give people introductions into both of those things and actually build their own tools for doing secure code review, utilizing LLMs. Utilizing the different techniques and really getting into the nitty-gritty. One of the complaints that we get often for both secure code review and harnessing LLMs in the courses that we teach is it's a lot of technical content without the time that they need to actually figure things out in the labs. This is a four-day course that will allow us to give students the time to really dig in, make sure that they accomplish all of the tasks that have been put forward, and to do the exercise and play with the different tools in a, yeah, in a secure manner, I guess, right? So there's a lot that's going on. Secure code review, practical secure code review. We are working on an online course for that as well. Self-paced course. It's not getting as much. It's not moving as quickly as I would like, but that's basically my own fault for not having enough time and being able to create more time during the day. Yeah, Ken, anything else? Like, are you going to any conferences? I think you mentioned Global AppSec DC coming up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I'm glad you asked that, because this happened yesterday. We were able to get a booth, but we're going to... We weren't able to get the booth size that we wanted, so we're going to be in the startup, I think, booth size. But anyways, I'll be there. And then, I don't know, I was thinking about, like, I saw Sean Porras mention B-Sides Nova, which I didn't even know was going on. It's later
this weekend, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's in Arlington, Virginia or something, but so that's not too far. I may try to, it's like a $50 ticket. I may just try to pop over there just for at least one of the days. I think it's a 2-day thing. And then like you said, I guess, man, I guess Black Hat's the next one. The real, you know, besides Global AppSec. Time, yeah. The thing we, yeah, actually, Robert, it's funny you say that because we spent, speaking of time, the time we spent not going on live at noon exactly on the head was us talking about how we neither of us has any time. So. Yes.
How the only time we get to catch up is the post and the pre and post show. And sometimes the post show doesn't actually exist, right? Because we have to bounce to other things. So,
yeah. I do have one piece of news, though.
Okay.
This is a pretty big one. This is my first ever pumpkin spiced latte. I wanted to see what the hype was about. And I got to tell you, it delivers. It is. My wife's over here smiling because she got it for me. But I do like it. It's made the pumpkin spice. I get it now. You sold me it. Earth on it. Yeah,
that's my question as well, is how is this your first? And so basically, you know, so you're just a basic white girl at this point. Is that what you're saying? Right? Like, yeah.
Let's start wearing leggings and
you got some Lululemons that you're wearing right now. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. It is delicious. Really good.
I did not know that's where the podcast was going today, but that's great.
Neither did I. Yeah. First ever.
You got some nice sugar rush and some nice pumpkin spice. Call it good. Well,
yeah.
Okay. So along the lines of, yeah, we're at the absolute absec Uggs, Crocs and socks, right? Yes. Along the lines of not having any time, there was a recent article, and this actually was one that popped up a couple of weeks ago, and we just didn't get an opportunity to talk about it. I've got the archive, the web archive link to it. This was a, I think it was Wall Street Journal article, right? That actually talks about AI startups. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, Ken, was specifically because the amount of time that you and I have spent building companies. But this article is, so it's titled, you know, where did I pull it there? You know, AI startup founders tout a winning formula. No booze, no sleep, no fun, right? Is the name of the article. And if you dig into it, right, like they interview one startup founder, right? Like, of course, these are all, you know, 20-year-olds, you know, 20 to 30-year-olds in San Francisco that are building startups. And they're talking about how it's pretty standard that they spend 90 hours a week on company stuff and actually, you know, building a company. My question is, to you specifically, Ken, like as a startup founder, as somebody that's building this, is this really what it takes to build a company, a tech startup? And I know this has gone around for a number of years that like this is like a committed environment that everybody's expected to spend all their time at a company. But do you personally feel like this is what it takes to actually build a successful startup?
I was trying to actually... What is the metric of success? Because I was trying to, what made them consider successful? Your primary working, instead he has raised 51 million. Okay, so you raised 51 million. You just have to work and be hardcore. because that's my first question. It's like, what is the reason that they're called successful? Because that's, you know, that's pretty... That can be a pretty subjective, because some people think like raising money is, that's a metric of success. And I guess to some degree, it definitely is, right? I mean, it at least shows that there's some traction. Really, though, success is like, you know, kind of a sustained long-term growth, you know, healthy business, healthy culture, lots of factors. So it's hard to, for me to pin down what is, you know, quote unquote success here. But so I, you know, and again, I'm pre-Series A, right? With the VC I'm at now. So, or sorry, with the VC I'm at now, with the stage I'm at now with VCs, it's pre-Series A. It's, you know, I've gone through a couple seed rounds. So I guess it's probably what I'm saying is, like, I don't know that I'm the, you know, like a genius or anything around, like, you know, what it takes to be successful, but I can tell you that, like, for me, that approach wouldn't work. And I know there's many reasons why. For one, I have a family, like, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And like, I'd wreck my life. So that's not a really great idea, but that's not the question, right? It's like, it doesn't matter about apparently my life, right? It matters about the company and hypothetically here. So if you weren't taking into account like the destruction of your personal relationships, and like you said, these are, I think even the article said 24-year-old kid basically, it's different. You know, you don't have those kinds of, I mean, you should still have friendships and relationships, but you know, you don't have, like, I have a 13-year-old. I have to, you know, spend time like with him. I need to. That's a good thing. That's what you want to do, right? Also, on top of that, I think like I'm already. And I should also say, like, I've done both, right? You and I have both, like, we've done both. I've done the, like, literally working to the point where I go home only to shower, and then I come in, sleep for 2 hours on the floor. And, you know, I did that. That's what we did for years at the old consultancy, right? It's just, it's how we got off the ground in the first couple of years. So I've done that. I guess the point is, like, I don't think with all of this, there's any like right or wrong way to approach anything. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like every business is a little different. Every group of people is a little bit different. What works for some won't work for others. I know like in our culture and our company, we have a lot of, to deliver and disrupt the industry, we had to hire like the people that were the best at what they do, which means they're very experienced, which means they have like a life around them, right?
Yeah.
And I expect them, just like I wouldn't expect me, to like cut off all healthy things, like, you know. And actually, Cole Cornford will tell you the same. He's built a pretty decent business out there in Australia, and he and I have talked about this, so I know he'll tell you the same. It's like, you got to have some balance. Like, I can't really make, also, here's another thing too. When you're 24 years old, you probably don't think too much about, I don't want to be offensive to anybody, so I'll just say, like, there are certain things that you aren't going to take into account tomorrow. You're going to think a lot about today. And over time, you can have a very destructive to your own business ramifications from driving not only yourself, but everybody else. And I'd say, like, with leaders, driving yourself and everybody else into the ground. I'm just trying to wrap this up because I feel like I've been long-winded, but I guess what I'm trying to say is you can actually make a lot worse decisions if you're sleep deprived. You can make much more rash decisions. And like, working hard is kind of just, I'll say this, working hard is table stakes. I never understood why people like really focus too much on that as part of like running a business. It's like, yeah, that's hard, you know, whatever. Like, that's just table stakes. What actually really matters, and what has been impactful for us, is to be really mindful about the decisions we make, right? And if I'm making those decisions just constantly, you know, hammered with, lack of sleep and stress and, you know, all day long just thinking, for me, that's not gonna, I'm not gonna make good decisions. I'm not gonna be somebody you want to even be around, to be frank. So I don't know, what do you think about this? I mean, you've done what we do for even longer than I have, and I feel like you've run at least businesses, and you actually also, to a degree, almost a third one, because you led, you were a principal and you pretty much led our AppSec group into being a thing that people bought from Fishnet Security, you and Fergie. So
Fergie anyway. And then Hamill came in. Yeah. Anyway. Yes. So my inclination here, like when I first read this, is similar to like what Robert is saying on Slack, like everybody likes to hype working hard. Because we get these stories like you know, like this article, and we see representations of people that worked hard and were successful, right? It's very rare that you actually talk to the people that put in, we don't celebrate people that work hard and put in 90 hour weeks and then aren't successful at launching a company or getting that next round of funding or whatever else it is. The cautionary tales aren't as popular because they don't get the eyeballs, they don't get the looks, and they also just aren't as inspiring to keep people like diving in and working really hard at whatever company they're at. So I kind of go back, like this article piqued my interest after we were at B-Side San Francisco, right? We're sitting down outside and we're talking to some of the attendees. And of course, a couple of them, I think there was that series of like three or four that were all like founders, right? That were sitting at this table. Yeah. They're all like, oh, well, you know, I just finished at Y Combinator. And right. Like, and you know, they're all working probably like 90 hour weeks to build their companies. And Y Combinator, like, okay, here's your business plan, now go. Yeah, it's just like this whole other mentality of I just grind until I make it, which works at a certain level. But to your point, Ken, the more it's diminishing returns, right? Like when you don't turn off your brain, when you don't actually do something else and refocus and let yourself settle and remember why you're doing this, it becomes less effective over time. It's the same thing as programming. It's the same thing as, you know, any time that you become too focused on one single activity and don't actually try to take care of yourself and your loved ones and other people, it will be detrimental over time to that main activity that you're trying to drive. Like, I go back to just like athletics in general and training, right? Like, Ken, you do BJJ. It is not something that you can do 24 hours a day, right?
No,
right? Like, even like you have, yeah. It's like any activity, the more that you focus on it, and just because you love it and you want to be successful, doesn't mean that you don't have to plan it out appropriately in order to be successful. So a lot of times we equate grinding and putting in hours to success when in fact you're actually making things worse over time by being involved, by doing late night pushes, by introducing bugs when we are like half baked or we're just like not operating at 100%. And we have a hard time recognizing when we aren't able to do that. So
yeah no, you're right. Yeah. I mean, like, it's actually, and Robert kind of he added on to what you're saying is like, if you're only doing that one thing and you're only doing that, like you just said, like that one thing that's only your focus and all that, you know, there are periods of time where for me that's, I mean, in the last few years, there was a period of time where for months on end, I wouldn't say 24/7, but I was throwing myself, when I say throwing myself, I mean, like, it was definitely to an unhealthy level, but it's like, I'm trying to disrupt like the billion-dollar corporations that put out these old crappy SaaS tools. Like, it's going to require some of that. So there are periods, but to what you're saying is like, when you do that for too long and you're just focused on the one thing, this thing that Robert said is very true. Like, you know, it's like, you don't make this decision making is so important. That is so, and it's not just here's the thing too, like one thing that maybe is obvious to people or maybe not, I don't know, but what I've found is that some of the most important decisions it's not obvious, and even sometimes the most important input you get from people, it's not obvious. It's not like anybody's like, you know, in school where they like stomp on the floor and say like, pay attention, this is important. Nobody does that. You have to be able to read between lines, which is very tough for me to do. As somebody who needs people to be very blunt. So reading between the lines and seeing nuance and asking more questions when someone says something, because they might say it just for a second. It might be the tiniest thing you've ever heard, but it actually might be the most important thing. It's hard to recognize those things if you're just so myopic. And the last thing I'll say too is, like, beyond just like being exhausted and not making good decisions, is that there's also this weird thing where, like, I'm not saying you don't work towards the goal, but if you hold too close to your chest, I found for me, I don't know if this is true for everybody or if this is even true in life, but I will say this. If I work hard towards a goal, that's not the same as being like, I absolutely have to have this outcome. This outcome has to occur for me. When I tie myself to an outcome and like my desire becomes, you know, overwhelming for that outcome, it actually has a weird opposite effect. Everything gets worse. But I got to tell you, the best, most successful moments I've had in my life are the moments where I didn't give a shit. I just went and did whatever I thought needed to be done. And man, does it turn out well? You know, that's true in career choices. That's true in little smaller day-to-day decisions. It's true in so many ways. So there's a lot of wisdom and experience that you gain. And so I can say that, like, there are pros and cons to a 24-year-old founder that works 24/7. And there are pros and cons to someone like me, who's a 42-year-old founder who has come in with prior experiences and had run a business before and has done the whole grind and not sleep thing before and has seen both sides and definitely prefers the side that's not the 24-hour grind.
Yes.
But also, hey, yes. This is also the other thing too, is like, what do you consider work? Cause like, there'll be times at night where I'm, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm not really at a keyboard, but I have a big customer out in Asia and they ask questions and need some support and all that. And it's like, I'm replying on my phone. Is that work? You know, is that work in real late hours? I mean, it doesn't feel like it just feels like I'm helping somebody. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and I think that's part of it, right? Like, we were also talking before the show about how life in general and like running a business, being in a startup, being a product has pushed us to be less technical, right? And, you know, there's a myriad, you know, there's a whole number of articles about, you know, what, you know, moving from technical to being like in management and whether or not that's something we want to be, or you want to stay as an IC in a large company. But it's a struggle, right? Like, you want to be successful. You have to trust other people. You can't necessarily be the one that is always fixing or building or delivering, because you are trying to create a team, because you are trying to create a company to do those things. And there are aspects that aren't necessarily as rewarding. And so it's hard at times to stay connected to that. But to your point, right, like answering a question, being able to interact with a customer and, you know, like have some of that technical discussion doesn't necessarily feel as burdensome to being, yeah, you know, to doing, I mean, basically running numbers and having to report to the board or to VCs or whatever it is. Like, there are different aspects, and that's what you have to hang on to when you are in those situations, right? Like, yeah, I typically get a lot more out of the, you know, the hours of testing or of code review or other things when I'm deeply focused, and I come out of those fairly energized when that's really work, right? Like, that's really right, like what we're delivering as a services company. But it's a lot harder to get as excited about the sales cycle or, you know, trying to find like that avenue of how we can deliver and talk to the right person at this company so we can actually deliver those services. That's a lot more tiring to me.
That's so true. I put something on LinkedIn about Vanta and being all excited about their security questionnaire for this reason, because filling out a spreadsheet all day long of security questionnaires whenever we're going through procurement with these companies, that sucks, man. That's not really like fun for me. That is work. But to your point, if I go and I do something else, it could be even late at night. I could be exhausted. It's not filling out a spreadsheet. I might be stoked and loving that. It doesn't feel like work. Like, if I'm coding up some new feature or prototyping something, dude, it doesn't feel like work at all. It feels like,
Yeah. Feels like a break, right? Like, no, it does, right? And that, and that's a lot of like where the companies and those good ideas and those associations come from when you are building something that is fairly, that becomes innovative, right? Yeah. Cool. Okay. So along those lines, this is the natural like progressor to that. And I'm driving the conversation for us today. But Frank Wong on Frankly Speaking, his most recent post is about security companies in general. And the question is, will security companies disappear? And like here, I'm going to show this one really quick. It's a great premise, right? Like this, this idea, he's talking about the inefficiencies in security, right? And over the past decade, like the initial narrative for security in general was it was underfunded, understaffed, and we were lacking resources to actually go after security issues within companies and actually fix them. And that narrative is now flipped when you talk to a lot of big companies. Look at the size of the team in your own experience, Ken, at GitHub, right? Like when you first joined, product security was a very small team. By the time that you left, security is basically a behemoth over there. And I've seen this happen at a number of different companies that I work with where security was nimble. They were trying to push out solutions and identify gaps. And all of a sudden it became security is the behemoth in the room, is almost driving product development and is actually slowing down sales and technical resources because they've become too much of a stopgap, right? And not necessarily in a bad way, like protecting consumers, protecting the company, but they have slowed down innovation for these companies because they have to be considered and they have to be involved in every decision. But to Frank's point here is that security teams today in this situation have more resources than ever, but it doesn't feel like they're solving the right problems.
Well, he points out all the point solutions, you know, and like everybody purchased a bunch of different products and like we're not solving the right problems. And he talks correctly, I think, about how AI vibe coding or AI, I mean, I don't know if he called it vibe coding, but AI assisted coding, it speeds things up, right? So you got one person that is like, maybe wasn't the best coder and definitely was like, well, I'm not going to build this before, or, you know, a few people who are like, I'm not going to build this. I got to get like, go purchase from a startup to do that for me. So, you know, I don't have to. And, I don't disagree like there, because I've gotten on calls and I've talked about this before on the podcast where like, there's some, I've gotten on some calls for some things, some potential new, some companies had been founded for some potential new solutions, things that we had built internally. And we thought, well, surely like we built this internally. So like maybe there's some like way better professional options out there. We get on the calls and we were like, dude, like your whole company was funded and has a worse product than the thing that we built internally, which is just a sidecar to our product to like do either security mechanisms or evaluation mechanisms, right? And I'm like, it kind of blew my mind. I was like, wow, this is the state of things. So like people get funded all the time. He points this out in the article. That's why I'm saying it. He points out like, yeah, there's companies that get funded, startups where it's like hard to believe they're a startup. It's like something that you could now with like vibe coding kind of, you know, or do a hackathon and put into a dashboard. And there's whole companies being, you know, funded or in the past funded. So I don't disagree. Like that's, if I now have a coding assistant, which can help me write that thing that I didn't think I could maintain or write myself. Yeah, of course I'm going to go with it. I think he's somewhat correct in this part, unique data, like for the older incumbents, as I like to call them. But like, so like CrowdStrike, SentinelOne, and whatnot, they've got, I would imagine, sure, they've got lots of data. I think SemGrep over Snyk. I think SemGrep has more of community-driven rules written. So they have more, if they want to convert that into something more usable for like training a model or something like that, maybe they could figure out some way to transition their you know, that knowledge base into some training data, into an LLM or something. I don't know. Snyk, it's a little harder because Snyk, they also write rules, but it's just their rules and their rules aren't very good. And like, I'm just going to say it, like I Snyk is not having a good time. Right. And there's a reason. It's they were good for a while in the first couple of years, and then just not much has been done. So I don't know. I think maybe what they're saying though, so like there's the code scanning aspect and then there's the actual dependency aspect. And so there might be like interesting CVE data and things of that nature they have access to. That could be, but I mean, it's probably the same that everybody else is. I don't know if they're, I don't know if that company specifically that he called out will have as unique, meaningful data as he's projecting. But I do think that he's not wrong. Like these companies do have data warehouses, and what do we want with LLMs, especially if they're a domain specific LLM? We want domain specific training data, which is not a bad thing. So, and I'll say that, I guess the last point is like, yeah, even a company like mine, I mean, we have to educate users on why, like, yes, you could code up something that throws your, I don't know, pull requests or your source code or whatever at an LLM. SemGrep correctly pointed out that AI coding tools out of the box with even just like they're actually not even just out of the box with their code review capabilities as they are, they do have a lot of issues with like, you know, repeatability, with accuracy. That's why you have to use a professional product. And that's why like I have to sit there and educate people on that, which is like, no, yeah, you could use the Claude Security Review. There's a lot of other tools we offer besides just code review. But if that's all you want to just understand, that even that is going to have, you know, repeatability issues. It's going to have like, there's no way to really provide feedback. There's lots of things that aren't there. And, but if I don't do that, right, and somebody thinks that's just the one thing that we do and that's all we do, then yeah, they could be like, no, I'm not going to buy a dry run. I'm going to go and I'm going to build it, right? And I get that. So this whole article speaks to me, and I actually think there needs to be a kind of a culling of all of these different point solutions. Sorry, I think this pumpkin spice has got me off on a tangent today.
That's what happens, sugar and caffeine. Yes. Okay, there's a lot to unpack there, Ken. I would, you know, so in general, I agree that that there is going to be consolidation. To Frank's point, we have seen this cycle happen again and again in the security space. We build point solutions. The point solutions get sucked up by the incumbent players. They get rolled out in their products. And then we jump to the next hype cycle, right? Like, and so if you don't get acquired or you're not able to get to a point that your company is sustainable, right? Using that hype cycle to get you there, then the likelihood that you're going to be around in 5-10 years is probably pretty slim, right? So Snyk is a good example of this. Dependency management, you know, they started as a software composition analysis tool and integrated into the pipeline and were able to spin up, and then they've branched out from there. SemGrep is very similar to that, right? Like they started as a SAST, you know, a very quick like semantic grep tool looking for vulnerabilities and as a, you know, static analysis tool. And since then they have acquired other companies to actually build out their suite. So this is a story that's repeated over and over in the security space. And it seems that those successful startups, those successful point solutions, do get pulled into larger and larger either security companies or development engineering companies to actually be used and be given to a wider audience. you know, I've got friends in the compliance space, like Risk Recon, right? Like, I don't know if you remember those guys at all. But they got acquired by MasterCard, of all things, right? And MasterCard is using those that solution to actually evaluate vendors and, you know, improve their overall ecosystem of risk, you know, when they are evaluating third parties in general. And so the solution flipped from being like a, you know, they still offer it to third parties, right? You can go sign up and actually do, you know, this reconnaissance of your for your compliance needs. But MasterCard has made that their official like go-to as far as like compliance is, when compliance is required. And so, I feel like we'll continue to have these point solutions developed across whatever hype cycle we are currently in, whatever new technology is coming up. Like, obviously, all the AI startups right now, how that's actually being utilized will have an effect on the overall security market and will force some of those other point solutions out, or those companies will disappear, or they will pivot. And this all goes back to this idea that we go to companies specifically for their capabilities and their data, the way that they actually go about evaluating security and whether or not that's useful to us. I still maintain that having that data, training those models, having like some ability to be unique is what's going to save you at the end of the day, right? As a boutique firm, services specifically, people come to us because of the service that we provide that is unique, that is different than all the other pen testing firms that are out there. People are going to come to, you know, a startup, you know, Dryrun, because of the unique approach that you have to assessing the security of their code, right? If you don't have some sort of a moat that you create as a company, and this is just like business 101, the likelihood that you're going to stick around is pretty low because you're going to get subsumed, you're not going to be able to compete, whatever that is. Anyway, so I'm kind of going off there as well on a different tangent. But I don't think security companies fail or disappear. I think that they evolve.
Right? Yeah, I mean, they probably... I don't know, like... You're right. I mean, I think that they... I mean, we're definitely seeing more consolidation and more... I mean, I think that was part of ASPMs, right? Like, one is we were just generating so many bug tickets. Got to manage those centrally. And that comes down to, like, in a sense, managing risk through bug tickets. But I think the other part was, you know, like, let's just say it, ASPMs tend to offer multiple things. So a common one is you'll see SAST, you'll see maybe DAST, IAC, secrets, and container scanning, and SCA. I think those are the main ones. Now, having built a company that does one of those things, well, I guess a few of those things, but in any case, having done that, is it likely that a company that has been around for a year or two, or maybe even four, is doing all of those things incredibly well? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll just let that question float out there. But is it also not the case that does it matter, right? In the sense that if I can go to one vendor and they offer everything under that platform, maybe that's just all I need. Maybe that's all. And if nobody's complaining, especially, like, maybe that's all I needed, right? Is to just go to one person and get everything I need. So I think, you know, that's been a thing that's been every year. I feel like, especially around RSA time, somebody inevitably puts out the infographic that shows like all the security startups. And I mean, I feel like this is a conversation that's been happening since I started in security. And every year, someone's like, see, just too many solutions. And it's like, Maybe that's true. I don't know. Maybe it's not. I don't, you know, I think it's variety at least, but I don't really care either. Use them or don't. But one thing I will say is that I do really just want to go back to the fact that, like, if you're looking at that huge diagram of all those companies and you can pick out the ones where it's like, if I had a hackathon or a couple hackathons with my team, and then we dedicated somebody to, you know, X percent of their time to maintaining it. And we've got AI assisted coding tools, which will, you know, make everything go so much faster. Maybe I just don't buy, maybe those are just, that's just a category of tooling I don't need, or maybe that's just a whole set of companies that I don't need to go after. And I do think that that will lead to more build versus buy considerations. But I also am a realist and have seen this conversation many, 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 many years, it's the same as you, year over year, and it really hasn't changed.
That was my initial take as I saw this from Frank, was, you know, this is the same discussion that we've been having, and he does, you know, recognize that it's kind of the same discussion that we've had. We see this, it's the cyclical nature of business. And, you know, that RSA graph of all the different startups, I would argue that that's signs of healthy innovation and a healthy market, that there is a need for this sort of innovation to happen year over year and cycle after cycle. And we are getting better, right? Yes, there are breaches that happen on a daily basis. Yes, there are still security incidents. There's like all of this stuff with the supply chain attacks that have happened and people going after, you know, different developers in that space. But that's a natural progression of this cat and mouse game that's going on between attackers and defenders, and fraudsters and companies in general. And it's upped the stakes and made it more difficult to actually, number one, secure things, but also number two, attack things and get data back out. I mean, you and I remember being in the industry when SQL injection was just so, so prevalent. And basically there was no protections on data that was being hosted or being like pumped into any web application that was out there. And that's obviously gone away. That's changed quite a bit. The amount of times that we find SQL injection nowadays has just gone down and down and down, especially like useful ones that we could use to like leverage, you know, further exploit a system, right? That type of thing. And so like this cycle is just a continual like improvement of what's actually happening behind the scenes and the testing cycle that's in there. Could we be better at it? Yes, we definitely could. But it is signs of a healthy industry. I do you disagree with that, right? Like what is your feeling there?
No,
innovating. Like, I mean, or is like VC just pushing us to innovate when there's not necessarily the need to do that?
No, I don't think the VCs are, that's the thing is like, I think people, and that's why I'm taking my time on this, because I think, well, first of all, I don't think VCs are the reason that people, you know, the reason is that either they're, you know, not to simplify it, but they're typically like taking out, like, I want to innovate and disrupt something, right? Taking that motivation aside, right? Because that's kind of like, I mean, that should be everybody's sort of main primary driver. But after that, there's a theory that there's really only two. I think you can read this in the Founder's Dilemma book, but there's really only two motivations. There's like either power or money, right? And I mean, you have your, I obviously don't look too highly upon someone that's getting into this for power. Money makes more sense, right? Money makes a lot more sense. That's money makes the world go around, right? That is a true statement. And I guess why I'm saying that is like, you can't really blame VCs. There's always going to be somebody, whether they have the good intention of disrupting or not, there's always going to be somebody that wants to make money. And therefore, there's always going to be somebody walking in with a pitch deck trying to get some money from the VCs. Where you can blame the VCs is when they fund people that they maybe shouldn't have funded. But that's kind of a crapshoot in and of itself. Like, the dirty little secret of VCs, and I don't know if this is known, but I'll say it, is that they're typically looking for around one of their proper, because it's a lottery ticket. They're putting a little bit of money, but they're buying a bunch of little lottery tickets, and they're hoping that one of those has like a 50x return to make up for all the other failed lottery tickets that they've purchased. So, you know, VCs themselves are also incentivized to put enough of those lottery tickets out, but they're also incentivized to ideally do that for the right people. That's why they tend to do little tactics like try and ruffle your feathers during your calls with them, right? They want to see you're like, are you kind of a crazy person who can't handle yourself? Or, you know, maybe they want to see if you lie, right? Are you like a perpetual habitual liar? You know, anything they can suss out that points to problems down the road. But realistically, they only get so much time with you. You're kind of just moving through the rigmarole of those, or they are rather. And so I'm just trying to say, like, I don't think the VCs are telling people, look, take our money and go build something. I think people, it's the opposite, right? Where people are going to them. And then I think, like, yeah, truly, I think then what happens is, you know, you see greed. You just see greed. And also you see sometimes great company. I'm not trying to pick on Sneak. It's not my intention. I'll say this. I'm going to give them a compliment. They did such a great job in the first couple of years of getting adoption, of building something people, you know, wanted to use. And they did such a great job. Now, what happens is I feel like later forces come along and they get you to focus on, for them, probably a lot of go-to-market features and a lot of enterprise level kind of things, right? And that all makes sense. But the problem is that if you then also don't listen to don't try to improve upon your core premise constantly and listen to people, then, you know, you get stale. But anyways, where was I going with that? Yeah, so you see people that get funding because they just want to build companies and make money and whatever. And, you know, it's like they do a disservice to the industry. And then other times it's, I think also there's that thing of like, I can do it better than anybody else kind of mindset that you see in founders, which is a good thing, I think. I mean, you don't think you'd have founders and innovation without that, but like sometimes it's not the case, you know? And then you're like, all right, there's 17 of this category of tooling and most of them are shit, you know? I don't know, man. Yeah, I don't know the answer, but I definitely don't think it's people, you know, or VCs are the fault of a VC or something like that.
No. I mean, VCs do introduce, like, they give capital and the ability for these companies to start up and to try, right? Which is why they are successful and why they are good. And they, you know, they definitely are trying to cover the odds, right? You know, like as you were saying. But this is what it comes to, is consolidation is coming, to Frank's point, right? Like, we're going to see AI security companies get snapped up. We're going to see them combine. We're going to see security companies in general continue to consolidate and be pulled into the large ones that have been around for years and years, because they know how to take a startup that is or take a product that is half baked and working well and integrate that in, and then to sell it to large corporations, to governments, to other places, right? Like it's wholly appropriate, I guess.
Can I refine something I said, which is about VCs? Sure. There's like actually two, I'm sorry. There are two ways that I see this being them contributing to the problem or yeah. So the first way is I'll go back to finishing off the last. So the first way would be what I kind of described, and I think he actually says this in this article, which is focusing more on shareholder and VC and board member opinions than market reality. And that is how you get into a situation where your product doesn't keep up with the trends of the market and the needs of the market. So that's one way. And those pressures, and I've been told this many, many times, once you, especially like it's already, but especially once you hit Series A and a beyond, every conversation that you have with your board and your investors is all about revenue. It's just numbers, 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 revenue, revenue, revenue. It's on you as the founder to have the wherewithal to say, to make those decisions we started this whole thing off talking about, which are very monumental sometimes and other times not as much. And you don't always know which is which decisions, but you're trying to make the best decisions you can. So that's the first thing is listening. There's a little blame there between both the VC and the founders. The second case is this, and this is probably the most nefarious one. I think it was Robert Hansen came out with an article where he was talking about certain cybersecurity. There's a certain part of the world where cybersecurity companies tend to come out of. And there was a trend where it's like, wow, nobody's seen this product. Nobody's really heard of this company and they have $100 million in funding. What's going on? And then they started doing a little digging and they realized, oh, you've got the CISOs for all these major companies on the board of the main VC that's investing in these companies, where then the companies they're investing in are putting these CISOs on the board of their main VC onto their website, giving them testimonials for something that doesn't actually exist. When he blew that story, or when that story came out, I was like, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that really hurts the ecosystem, hurts everybody all the way around. So those are I just want to revise. There are ways that VCs can be at fault here, but I wouldn't point to them as my first choice.
Okay. Makes sense. Let me see if we like how we can kind of put a bow on that, right? Differentiation matters. No, you didn't, right? Like the VCs, right? Like are definitely, you know, I mean, it all kind of contributes to the overall, I guess, stage of a company or the stage of a hype cycle or technology cycle, whatever you want to call it. Security companies are going to continue to be around because there is a need for it. And it's constantly evolving. If anything, things are moving faster with vibe coding, with AI. I guess I don't have a good answer there, right? For, you know, whether or not, you know, it's going to change, but at the very least, security companies aren't going to die, I guess is my final take there. Do you want to mention anything else? It feels like we're just getting started and it's already been almost an hour. So
I actually don't. So I had set this, my calendar, to say that we always go a little over and then we never did any catch up time. So I actually set my calendar to go 15 minutes over, but apparently I was put on a sales call anyways that like conflicted. So I have to actually bounce now to go to a sales call. So
okay. Well, with that, I will post the rest of these articles in the ones that we had called out that we might talk about today. We'll post them in the newsletter. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, please do so. Just absoluteappsec.com. We're trying to get more consistent about sending that out on a weekly basis, summarizing what we've talked about, or at least like what we've talked about in the last couple of episodes, and including articles of interesting things that are going on in the space. So sign up now at absoluteappsec.com. Otherwise, yeah, I think that's everything for today. Thanks for the interactions. Thanks for listening. Please reach out, join us in Slack if you would like to continue the conversation. And yeah, otherwise we will see everyone, I think, next week for episode 300. We're going to have to figure out some sort of a giveaway or something to go along with episode 300. But
I would love to do a giveaway for folks. Yeah, let's talk more about that. I do have to run though. So.
Okay. Well, thanks all for joining today. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.